I think it's important for me to just say a few little remarks of the prelude here. I came here tonight unwilling to defend anything that I believe. I am not going to defend it. I am here to share with you the liberating truth of the good news of the gospel. And what I firmly believe is the truth not only for me, but for all people. I also want to say to you, the Bible was not written in English. There is no excuse for people pretending that it was, or for mistranslating the Greek or the Hebrew in a way that clearly reflects social prejudice and doesn't really deal with root words. While I won't defend anything, I will share this information with you. Malakoi means morally soft. Somebody who does not have the courage of their convictions. We know that is an accurate translation because Jesus himself will use that word in Luke 7, verse 25, when he says to the crowd gathered around about John the Baptist, "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? Someone clothed in Malakoi, soft raiment." People clothed in soft raiment live in palaces, in white houses. They do not have the courage of their moral convictions. That is what we are talking about in that passage. Arsenal Cortes is a Greek word that's only used two places in the New Testament, and there is not a reputable scholar on the face of the earth who will say that they know exactly what that word means. It's a compound word. It's two words put together. One word seems to refer to males, and one word seems to refer to beds. And the best they can say is that it's a nasty word. It implies a lot of force. And it may well be close to our F word as a verb. No way. I don't go any farther than that. If I was going to refute anything, I might share with you that Jude's reference to strange flesh is not at all a reference to homosexuality. There's nobody in their right mind that would say strange flesh means homosexuality. In fact, it's a reference to a story in the book of Genesis about angels and giants sleeping with the daughters of the earth. It's about crossing over boundaries that God had established. Humans are supposed to relate to humans, and giants are supposed to relate to giants, and angels are supposed to relate to angels, at least in that person's view. Has nothing to do with homosexuality. So part of me feels like I should just apologize to all the members of Metropolitan Community Church, Reverend Gail and her flock from Renewed Life Ministries, Reverend Edgar, for dragging you into this. I didn't mean to subject you, I'm very serious. I did not mean to subject you to negative things. And I'm hoping tonight that your faith is strong enough to simply withstand what I viewed as an onslaught, not only against queer people, but against the Bible. And what the Bible really does in regard to my faith. Talking about toiba or abomination. It is my fervent conviction that it is toiba, that it is an abomination before God when we affirm characteristics about God that are not true. We are then worshiping a false God. If we want to line up and say, God condemns people simply on the basis of who they are, that's a false God. That's not the God I worship. So stay with me here. I'm talking about a God who loves the people that were created, all of us, created in the image of God. I want to talk just quickly here about Romans 1, because I think it's a passage that is misused over and over and over again. In my last 20 minutes, I'm going to try to get to some positive passages about queer life also. But I just want to say to you that Romans 21 is another one of those passages where there is no excuse for not studying the Greek, for not studying the context. Every preacher worth their salt. person who's ever been to seminary has no excuse for not knowing that the Greek there, physine, natural, and paraphysine, beyond nature, is what it means, is also used in Romans 11:24, where it says that God asks paraphysine in saving the Gentiles. Now, what does that mean? Beyond nature. God acted beyond nature. What does that mean? God did something that people weren't accepting as the norm in terms of their understanding of God. They thought God should only save the Hebrew people, the Israelites. But God did something paraphysine, beyond what was expected, and saved the Gentiles. Those are the words that are being used in this Romans 1 passage. You cannot, on the basis of biblical scholarship or commentary, then conclude that that's condemning homosexuality. We also know a lot of other things about the Roman community. We do know that there was a lot of stuff going on in Rome. Many historians will tell you that. We also know that there was a heavy outbreak of syphilis in Rome during the period that Paul is writing. And we know that once again, as I told you, this text is related, I think, to the Levitical text, that once again, there were people practicing what I would call cultic sexual sacrifice. Not prostitution, because I'm unwilling to condemn other people's religious practices, but cultic sexual sacrifice. And there weren't the kinds of medical treatments or applications available now, so many people were suffering bodily for that practice. And Paul may well be addressing that, but again, that has nothing to do with homosexuality. Some of those people are practicing heterosexual behaviors, some of them are practicing homosexual behaviors. All of them are practicing what they think offers their God praise and adoration, whether we think that or not. I also just want to say quickly to you that I personally, I think resent is the right word, being defined as a behavior. I am not a behavior.
All right.
I have certain ways of relating romantically in this world, but that is only one small part of who I am. And anybody who has ever worked 70 or 80 hours a week like I do knows what a very small part of the whole part of it. As I said before, I actually believe that the scriptures have something positive to say about queer life, and I want to talk about that just a little bit here. I want to talk a little bit about Matthew 19 that was brought up. What Jesus actually is doing there is talking to some religious leaders who want to find a reason why they can divorce their wives, and why they can make those women homeless, and why they can refuse to support them and their children. And Jesus refuses to give them an excuse for doing that, and takes a very harsh stance, a very, absolute stance against divorce in that passage. And then the disciples say, this is Matthew 19 we're talking about here, the disciples say, oh, who can live according to that? And Jesus says, well, it's not for everyone, because not everyone is going to get heterosexual marriage. He says there are eunuchs who are born this way. There are eunuchs who have been made this way by other people. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves this way for the sake of the reign of God. That word eunuch is a very complicated term in the scriptures, actually. It is used in many different senses. We'll find it throughout the book of Genesis, chapters 39 through 45 are just filled with the use of that term. We'll find it in the book of Esther. It's the eunuchs who carry the messages back and forth between Mordecai and Esther. We'll find it here in Matthew 19. We'll find it again in the book of Acts when the young man from Ethiopia encounters Philip on the road to Gaza. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it can mean many things. It can mean a court official. It can refer to someone who has been castrated and therefore been made safe. to live in the quarters of the women on behalf of the king, and the king won't have to worry about anything else extracurricular going on there. It can also mean barren people, barren men, barren women, people who don't produce children. It can also mean people who are cut off from the community in some way. It is the contention, not only my contention, but many modern biblical scholars think it's a word that actually refers to a lot of the marginalized people in Scripture, and a very good word, sexually speaking, to describe queer people, because we are marginalized from the wider community. If you recall, in Isaiah's 56th chapter, Isaiah will talk about forming a house of God for all people, and will say to the eunuchs, I will give a name better than sons and daughters. I will give an everlasting name that shall never be cut off. To me, that's the promise for queer life in Scripture, and a positive thing about our place in Scripture. Whether we fit the social norm or not, God claims us for the promise and makes a place for us in the house of God. The eunuch in Acts 8, chapter 8, the Ethiopian eunuch, as we call him, what had he been doing? He had been traveling in Israel to offer sacrifice to Israel's God, and he's on the way home. And how does Philip get into this picture? Do you remember? The Spirit just whisked Philip into this picture, and he just ends up there. And the eunuch is riding along in his chariot, reading from Isaiah 53. Reverend Nancy Wilson likes to say suspiciously close to Isaiah 56, but he's reading Isaiah 53, and Philip asks him if he understands what he's reading, and the eunuch says no, he doesn't. How could he? He's had no one to explain it to him. So Philip falls up in the chariot and begins to explain it to him, and the eunuch then asks the defining question. I think the defining question for all of Christianity: what is to prevent me from being included in the community of faith? And Philip says nothing, and baptizes that man, and really lives out that promise of Isaiah 56, a house of God for all God's people. There are many passages like that that I think speak in a positive way to queer life. I think the story of Jonathan and David speaks in a very positive way to queer life. Here we have a young man who's married more than once. David has 8 wives, and God knows how many other people he has some kind of liaison with. But he forms a sexual relationship with a young man, Jonathan. We know of sexual relationships. For example, 1 Samuel chapter 20 talks about David and Jonathan hiding in the bushes and David exceeding himself. Lots of people will say they are baffled by that word. They have no idea what it means. Prior to exceeding themselves, they were kissing and caressing each other. I think I have a sense of what that word means, David exceeding himself. Jonathan will refuse to eat, refuse to show up to dinner when Saul says he's going to go after David. In the end, when Jonathan is murdered in battle, David will pen these words: Jonathan, your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women, and mandate that those words be recorded in the book of the just, and that all Israel memorize them. Maybe to say to people for all time, it's not so important who you love, but it is desperately important that you love, and that you love in a way that honors one another, which is what I think Jonathan and David strove to do. So that's a good part. Ruth is another example of that. I'm going to have to go quickly with Ruth here. Ruth is a Moabitess woman. She is actually a descendant from the Sodom and Gomorrah story. The two tribes that the daughters produced were the Ammonites and the Moabites. Ruth is of that tribe. She ends up marrying into Naomi's family, marrying Naomi's 2 sons. Everybody dies, no? Naomi's husband, Naomi's son. These 3 women are left. Orpah goes back to her family. You know, that's a very funny side story there, because Oprah is named after Orpah, like her family misspelled it, so, but anyway. Or goes back to her family. Ruth says to Naomi, what? For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. May God do this to me and more, if even death parts me from you. It is the only pledge of relational fidelity in the Bible, and it is between two women. To make a long story short, they go back to Bethlehem, where Naomi has recently come. Naomi's hope, this is very important, Naomi's hope is that one of her male kin will claim her and redeem her place in society. Ruth has no standing. She is a foreigner. They go back. Her only hope is that somebody will claim her. No one claims her because she's an old woman and cannot build up their house. So Ruth gleans the fields to provide for both of them, to feed them. And Boaz takes notice of her and asks about her and allows her to glean in an unmolested fashion. In the end, Naomi will give her instructions and Ruth will essentially propose to Boaz, I guess you could say, get Boaz to sleep with her, although it appears that he's a little bit drunk that night after a big party. Legend has it that he died the very next day, but we'll read that story and is impregnated. Ruth gives the child to Naomi and plays the role of Goel, which is Hebrew for redeemer. It's Ruth, not Boaz, who redeems Naomi's place in society by giving her that child, which is her social security form in that society. And the townspeople verify this by gathering around at the end to say, Ruth is better to you than seven sons. They know what role Ruth has played for Naomi. She has redeemed her place in society. I would say that that's what love does. That's what lovers do for each other. We give each other back our place in society. It's what Jesus will do when he goes back for Lazarus at the tomb. He not only calls him to life in a spiritual sense, but this guy is dead and sealed away. He gives him back his place in the world. Because why? Because he loves you. That's all the note says. The one you love is ill. So I hope that you're going to leave here tonight with some sense that what clear love does is redeem. It saves people's place in society. It gives them back a sense of belonging and a way to survive in this world. I hope that you're going to leave here tonight with a sense that the scriptures say something positive about our people, that this book is our story too.